You are listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines around our area this week. And today, our panel includes Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press, as well as the voice of the Eye on Boise blog, Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Statesman, Dawn Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So, Audrey, can we start once again with the pandemic? Where we are, because the governor earlier this week reactivated the National Guard.
Yeah, happy to bring you the latest upsetting news about COVID. I do actually have some not so terrible news to share, but yes, the governor had to reactivate the or call up the National Guard again to help healthcare meet demands. So he mobilized forces, guardsmen, to work in at Primary Health Medical Group, and also is calling in on staff to work in hospitals through a contract. And I'm trying to get more details about that contract and what it entails, but it's more than 500 personnel to help with the current Omicron surge. And where we are with that is that this past week, Idaho hospitals had more than 600 patients with COVID-19 in beds on average per day. But the hopefully good news is that we're seeing positivity rates go down, which means that there's not as much wildly unchecked spread of the virus. And I'm starting to see the increase in hospitalizations slow down pretty significantly over the past few days. And so hopefully we're at a point where we might be reaching a peak.
So with that said, Audrey, do we have any information then on this sub-variant? Because we know that we had one case, I mean, it was detected in Ada County a week ago today, and that has kind of slowed the surge in other countries, but I don't know if we have enough information to know that, because what you did say, I mean, this is good news that we're starting to see things slowing down.
Yeah, and I think everyone saw that subvariant and thought, oh no, look what happened in Denmark.
Right.
Is that going to happen here? But we don't know. And I think everyone wishes we could have every single data point possible on this pandemic. Right. It just is not possible. And so what we're getting right now is we don't know how much of the current Omicron cases are the subvariant. It's just being added in under Omicron on the state's dashboard. But, you know, hopefully we've had enough people get vaccinated and unfortunately had, you know, enough quote unquote natural immunity that it can help hold off that subvariant and not have yet another surge. Because, you know, it's for healthcare workers, for families, for everyone, this has felt kind of like, you know, if anyone's ever gone whitewater rafting and you fall out of the raft, it's like, you know, catching your breath between waves. And this last surge was like, oh my gosh, can we even get a break? So hopefully that's coming.
Yeah, hopefully. Fingers crossed on that. So let's turn to the State House, because a lot going on there. Betsy, can we start with a rental fee application bill? This has gotten a lot of attention. In particular, I've seen quite a bit of talk and chatter on social media about this. So can you tell us what this is and then where we are with this?
Sure. So this bill was proposed by Representative Joe Palmer from Meridian. And it would basically erase a local ordinance that Boise has had on the books since 2019, putting a $30 cap on rental fee applications and imposing some other measures in the face of the housing crunch that the area has been experiencing. Representative Palmer argues that local governments shouldn't be able to regulate anything in that area, and it should be just left up to business. And so his bill came up for a full hearing in the House Business Committee, and the testimony was overwhelmingly against it. The only people in favor were a property manager, an apartment association guy, and a self-described mom-and-pop landlord. Everybody else, including housing advocates, renters, government representatives, citizens, and others, pointed out lots of problems with this given the current affordable housing crunch in Idaho. Nevertheless, the committee, after quite a lengthy hearing, passed the bill on a straight party line vote, with all 14 Republicans voting in favor and only the two Democrats on the committee voting against. And the bill is now pending in the full House, ready for a vote in the full House. It follows a pattern that the legislature has established in recent years of preempting local regulations in a number of areas, on everything from, you know, short-term rentals to whether or not you can use plastic bags at grocery stores. The legislature has pretty much staked out ground saying, we want to decide all these things and not let local governments decide them. Another area where they've passed legislation on that is regarding minimum wage, that we can't have any local minimum wage ordinances in Idaho. But this one really strikes a nerve because of the extremity of the current affordable housing crisis in Idaho.
Well, in particular, though, too, Betsy, that there was such opposition around this, but it seems that that ended up not mattering.
And, you know, that's really a common pattern that we see here at the legislature and have for quite a number of years. If the majority party has staked out a position, it doesn't seem to matter how much opposition or from which corners it comes. It's going to pass.
Rachel, can you talk to us about a Canyon County commissioner who is under quite a bit of pressure to resign?
Yeah, so on Wednesday morning, we heard that eight Canyon County elected officials, so these are commissioners, the clerk, the sheriff, all signed a letter basically stating that, you know, they've lost faith that Canyon County Commissioner Leslie Van Beek, you know, can stay in her position. I'm still trying to get the details, but basically they said that she's been using confidential information and talking about the elected officials with other people in the county, county employees. You know, she sent a letter back to them, and she also made it public saying that she wanted to see exactly what they were accusing her of and invited, you know, them to have a conversation. But yeah, so basically Leslie Van Beek, you know, in the 3 years that I've covered the county, she does kind of stand out from the other two commissioners. So it's a board of three Canyon County commissioners. And she, you know, she kind of stands out. She's outspoken on things. And, you know, it kind of seems like that all came to a head. And like I said, I'm still getting the details. And once I do, that will be, you know, in another story online. But yeah, basically, and also just to add, Commissioner Van Beek indicated that she was not planning to resign. So, you know, in order for her to get out of the position, it would have to be a recall, which would be signatures from voters, et cetera. So that's what we're looking at in Canyon County this week.
So all we know at this point then, if I'm understanding you right, Rachel, is that there is this letter from other elected officials. They say she's misused confidential information and defamation, I guess, of other elected officials.
Yes.
But that's it. We don't know anything more than that.
Yes. Yeah. We don't know anything more. You know, I've asked the group of elected officials if they wanted to outline some things that they've said, some, you know, give me some, you know, documentation of anything that she said, and I haven't heard back. So yeah, that's all we know, is that, you know, this group of elected officials is saying this one thing. Leslie Van Beek is saying, you know, I have gone against this, quote, good old boys and girls club, and this is my punishment. I did nothing wrong. So.
And we should know the two of these elected officials are her work colleagues, the two other commissioners.
Yes, the two other commissioners have signed this letter.
Okay. Well, we will keep our eye on that. Dawn, my goodness. Construction work on Highway 55. Is it cursed? I mean, what in the world? It seems to be that they open it and then they close it. They open and they close.
Well, Gemma, I'm not one that believes in curses, although I do believe in karma, so I don't know what that
says. Okay, good one.
But I will say that this is a tricky deal. Yeah. As folks are surely know by now, Idaho 55 is the main link between the Treasure Valley and the McCall area. It's not the only link, but it's kind of the primary one. And there's a section of it that goes through a rather picturesque canyon along the Payette River, just north of Smith's Ferry. The Idaho Transportation Department hired Horrocks Engineering about 3 years ago to start on a project to widen the road. Well, that's a tough task because on one side of the road, you have a river, and on the other side, you have a cliff face. And I don't mean like, you know, like way over there on the other side of the river. I mean like, or on the other side of the road, like if you stopped, you could probably wave your hand out the car window and touch it. It's really close. So this was going to be a major project, and it's had lots of troubles. Right after it first launched, there was a major traffic jam because the flagging traffic lights didn't work and people were stuck in traffic for like 6 and 7 hours. And then last March, there was a landslide. And the transportation department at first said, you know what, it's not related to the construction. And that was reported widely. We followed up and they said, oh, well, actually, yeah, it was, which was logical, right? So when they first said that, we were like, really? Turns out, no, it was related. And then in November, it happened again. And this time, the slide was so massive that the road was closed for several weeks, including over the Thanksgiving holiday. Lots of businesses, especially on the portion of the Valley County area that was closer to the road, so think Cascade, were impacted because people just couldn't get to Cascade in an efficient way from the Treasure Valley. Now, in December, work closed for the winter season. Both lanes of the road were open, and late in January, another slide happened. So I know that's a lot of detail there, but I think it's important to point out that we've now had three landslides in less than a year in this construction zone. It's prompting a lot of questions. Our reporter, Margaret Carmel, and Autumn Robertson are both looking into this because we think there's unanswered questions that need more light, and so we're working on this. Earlier this week, I will say I was in McCall this week, and just as we were wrapping up to head home, I got a news release in my inbox, and it said that the department was going to put in shipping containers between the hillside and the roadbed. And I went, what? Yeah. So because I knew I was about to drive the road, right? Like so many
exactly
do. And so I called ITD spokesperson Vince Trimboli right away, and he told me that they are really trying to go above and beyond for safety, that there are no new geotechnical evidence that says that another slide is possible or could happen, that the road is safe, but they want to do everything they can. So the idea is these barriers would be in place. So if a slide happened and there were cars on the road or other vehicles, that it would help protect that. This is a dangerous situation. We've been very fortunate. No one has died. But you can look at the photos of some of these slides, and boy, Gemma, I'll tell you what, we're lucky that there wasn't a car full of people or frankly, a bus or something else in the way, because the results could be problematic. And so the transportation department, I think, knows that there's some serious issues. There are a lot of questions here in what's happening, and we're going to keep asking questions because we think it's really important to get to the bottom of what's happening. And I'll say, I spoke at the McCall Rotary this week. And the topic of conversation wasn't, you know, the endowment lands or any of the things that were happening in McCall. All people wanted to talk about with me was what's happening in Idaho 55. I think it's really something that a lot of people are trying to understand right now.
Mm-hmm. And Dawn, I mean, this might seem like a really basic question, but I mean, you know, I have been right through there. I think, you know, many people have while this construction is going on. And I mean, what was the reasoning behind ever widening that part of the road to begin with?
I will tell you this. That's a key question. One thing that, and I think Margaret's listening, so she can react to me on Slack and tell me if I'm right, but we're trying to get an answer to why this project and why not some other projects. I'll just tell you, lots of people are like, why didn't they just go over the river at Smith's Ferry and then up back around the other way? We don't fully understand if that was studied, how it was studied, what the reasoning was. We just don't know. And I'm not trying to say there's anything nefarious or anything here, but it's a question that I'm hoping to get answered so we can do a story. We do a lot of stories, frankly, that we just call You Asked, where people ask us questions. This has been one of the most asked questions. So we're working to get to the bottom of this. I always hate to talk about future reporting when there's lots of other reporters who can hear it. But I think it's really important to tell the public that this is something that we have a keen interest in and we're trying to get more details on.
Well, because I think you're absolutely right, Don, that when you look at the number of slides that have happened, it is frankly miraculous that there wasn't a car or a vehicle in that area when that happened.
Yeah, in any of these three, the slide more recently was fairly small compared to some of the others. Slides have happened in this area before, and
right.
I remember this, and I use this time anchor only because it was memorable. But the week of 9/11 in 2001, there was a slide on that road, and I remember it because working in news, it was the first thing that we covered that wasn't related to 9/11. And so there have been slides in that area for a long time. And we can't say, because the transportation department isn't saying we don't have any evidence, that these are all related to the construction work. We just don't know. But you have to look at it and say, gosh, there's been three slides in a year in an area where they're, I mean, if you've been through there since they started the work, holy cow. I mean, there's just so much happening. Rocks everywhere, big things pushed back. They've been doing blasting work. I mean, it is a big project. And so it just leaves, I think, people to have a lot of questions, and hopefully we can continue to get answers.
Yeah, I think more questions than answers, definitely. Let's take a quick break. We'll have more with our reporter roundtable next. Continuing our Friday reporter roundtable, our panel, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Statesman, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and Audrey Dutton with the Idaho Capital Sun. Betsy, there was another bill in the State House this week in regards to teacher health insurance. Can you get us updated on that?
That's right. And that's major legislation, and it has now won final passage in the Senate. There are only three no votes, and that bill is on the governor's desk. It's significant because in Idaho, and this is kind of counterintuitive, people probably would think that school teachers, as state employees, get the same kind of health insurance coverage as other state employees, and they do not. And in fact, the health coverage that's been offered to teachers and all other school employees in Idaho, all across the state, lags far below the level of what's been offered to state employees, including legislators themselves, to the point that teachers have been paying much, much more in premiums, getting a lot less in benefits, higher deductibles, often cannot afford to cover their families. And this has been a real obstacle for teacher retention and recruitment, particularly in rural Idaho. And so this year, with the state rolling in bucks, there's plenty of money this year. The governor and a number of legislators who've been working on this issue for years have come up with a plan to remedy that by bringing teachers up to the same level of funding for health insurance as state employees. The state spends about $8,400 per teacher per year for health insurance costs. It spends $12,500 per state employee or legislator. And that's what the bill does. There are several steps to it. The initial bill that is passed just creates a fund. And into that fund, the state could deposit, and the legislature would have to vote on that as well, an appropriation of $75.5 million to cover, at the option of school districts, any school district that wishes to opt in to the state employee health plan, actually get the teachers onto the state employee health insurance plan, which is a much better plan than what most of them have in their district. The districts would have the option of taking the increased funding that they're getting and not joining the state employee plan, but instead negotiating for better coverage for their employees there locally. They would get about $105 million a year more ongoing into the future to cover that difference in how it's been funded in the past and how it would be funded in the future. it is a huge deal for Idaho educators, for and for everybody who works for schools, you know, from the cafeteria workers and the bus drivers on up. We heard testimony in the course of the hearings on this bill that there are school district employees across Idaho who earn so little, particularly classified employees, not teachers, that at the end of the month, instead of getting paycheck, they actually have to write a check to the district because their wow. health insurance costs more than they're getting paid. We even heard from a legislator who said his wife was in that situation in the past. So it was pretty compelling stuff. It's got very strong support. That bill, I would think, is very likely to be signed into law. The governor has championed this change. And then there would be two more pieces following: the appropriations in the public school budget to cover the ongoing costs, and the appropriation of the one-time fund for the buy-in into the plan. Mm.
And then, Betsy, talk to us, too, about a recommendation from the governor. And this is in regards to a raise for state employees.
That's right. The state has really been struggling, as has pretty much every employer these days, to get and keep employees in the face of competition from other businesses that are paying much higher wages. And the governor this year recommended a 5% increase in the funding that the state provides for state employee compensation. That does not mean a 5% raise for every state employee. What he actually recommended was a 2% across the board, effectively a raise by shifting up the state salary schedule, and 3% for merit increases. The state usually does not give across the board raises. It does not give cost of living increases. Typically, all it gives is merit raises. So if someone is not performing super well in their job, they might not get any raise at all under the normal approach. This year, the governor had the 5% that was made up of 2% across the board and 3% for merit. Well, there's a joint legislative committee that reviews and holds hearings and votes on a recommendation as to whether they want to follow the governor's plan to do something different. And they considered a whole array of options, all of which were equal to or in excess of the governor's recommendation. What they finally settled on was $30 million more in total funds as far as cost to the state than the governor's recommendation, a little over half that in state general funds. And what they settled on as their recommendation is 3% across the board rather than 2%, and then up to $1.25 an hour for merit raises. And wow. So the effect of that is that those workers at the lower end of the wage scale would see larger percentage increases in their merit raises than those at the upper end. That was the way the proposal was designed by the proponent, Representative Scott Syme of Caldwell. Now, this joint committee makes a recommendation to JFAC, the budget committee, and they're the ones who actually make the final call as to what gets written into every state budget for funding. But the state has clearly got a problem recruiting and retaining state employees, and its wages have long been below the market. They've often said they make that up with benefits. But some of the studies show, even in that area, the state's got work to do. And so it'll be really interesting to see how this comes out. This decision needs to be made before JFAC starts setting agency budgets, which it's scheduled to do somewhere around February 18th, so that then whatever is decided upon can be written into every single state budget and funded.
Mm, okay, so it has to happen soon. Audrey, an Idaho lawmaker's retiring, Fred Woods, I'm curious about what this means in the legislature when it comes to dis and misinformation, because Fred Woods is a physician.
Right. Yeah. So Fred Woods chairs the House Health and Welfare Committee, and he has been in the legislature for 16 years. He told me it's been long enough. It's time for somebody else. He has things he wants to do. He wants to travel with his wife, but he is the last medical doctor or, you know, any kind of physician in the legislature. And there used to be three, at least three. There was a time when there were two other physicians in the legislature. They were defeated in 2016. And this past year, Representative Wood, he refused basically to hear any of the bills that were presented in the November with the legislature reconvene in November to consider making it illegal for employers to require vaccines or testing or anything like that. So he basically kept that all of that legislation from moving forward. We heard this past week, we've been hearing misinformation and disinformation in the legislature for the past 2 years. And it's interesting just to see, you know, Kerry Hanks talking about, well, if people were dying in the streets and we knew masks would keep that from happening, we would wear them, that sort of thing, versus Representative Wood encouraged the members of his committee to wear masks when they met, and mm-hmm. many of them did. And it's just, it's interesting to see like the different perspectives. Obviously a doctor who has been working for decades with patients is going to have a very unique perspective on health and public health. So we'll see, you know, we'll see what happens after he retires, but yeah, that's where we're at.
I think it's interesting that we're seeing this declining number of doctors serving in the legislature, to where we're down to one and he's about to retire. But at the same time, we're seeing an increasing number of lawyers serving in the legislature. There are more than half a dozen on the House Judiciary Committee alone. And I can remember not that long ago when there were hardly any lawyers in the legislature. When Representative Mark Stubbs was in the House, he was referred to as House Counsel because he was the only one. So we are seeing a shift in that professional makeup of our legislature.
And it's a citizen legislature. So it should, you know, we would think that it would be kind of representative of the citizenry. And we just don't have a whole lot of representation from the healthcare community there now.
Yeah, good point. Before we take a quick break, Dawn, there's literally going to be a brand new street near downtown Boise.
Yeah, sure enough. This has been in the works for quite a while, but it's starting to get close to moving forward. This is in the area of Fairview and Main Street. If you're an OG, you might remember this as the Roundtree Chevrolet lot. I think it was Larry Barnes Chevrolet before that. It's been vacant for decades. It's a big dirt lot. If you're a little less of an OG, you might remember that former Boise Mayor Dave Beter hoped to use this piece of land for a downtown ballpark. That didn't happen either. It was also eyeballed for a police station. That didn't happen either. Local developer Roundhouse has a plan in the works to build apartments on this site. The reason there will be a new street is because about 8 years ago, the developer traded to obtain this piece of land from the city of Boise, which had acquired it for that police station. And they traded the Spalding Ranch property in West Boise. Idaho law allows these types of trades, but they have to be equal. And the properties were not equal in value. And so one of the ways the city worked to diminish the value of the downtown property was to require that the developer cut a road through it. And that obviously means that chews up some of the land and just changes some of the dynamics. And that's the agreement that they came to. Now we're starting to see movement. And so you're going to see an extension of, and I don't have the story in front of me, I believe 28th Street. It's changed. And so it was either 27th or 28th through the property. And there will be at least in the first phase, a fairly significant apartment project built on one side of the street. And then I believe Roundhouse is planning to do additional apartment phases on the other side of the street. And so you're going to see a lot of change in this West downtown area. There are, besides those projects, there's like three other fairly large scale apartment complexes planned. And across the street, St. Luke's Health System has long been at work on a hospital that we reported a few weeks ago. They are changing the nature of. And so that project is starting to move forward. And this is an area that used to be kind of the way you got into downtown historically before the connector was built in the early 1990s. When that happened, it changed traffic patterns and kind of made it this quiet spot. But I don't think it's going to be quiet for much longer.
Yeah, it's interesting, Don. I mean, I remember when I first moved here that it was these big car lots. And then it's just been vacant, I mean, for 20 plus years, frankly. And it's so bizarre to go from such a vibrant downtown and literally only blocks away, you have like this open unused space.
You know, it's really kind of funny because you think about the growth here in the last 15 years and so much of it has happened, frankly, in Meridian. But you have these areas that are so close to downtown Boise. West downtown, obviously still in downtown, but that's an area that's been underdeveloped. And the other one we're starting to see a lot of change in is Garden City, which the location of that is phenomenal, right? Right along the river and close to downtown and easy to get on the connector and out to I-84. That's changing. The approach to growth is changing. The approach to transit and transportation is changing. And it's really a fascinating time to see how that's happening. And honestly, we're seeing it in the downtown Boise core too, really along Front and Myrtle. You're starting to see a lot of large apartment complexes in areas that were single family housing neighborhoods. And a lot of people lament the fact that that was lost. But we are seeing some change there as Boise grows up and starts to become more dense.
I swear every day there's like some new building or something I notice. I mean, for sure.
You swear every day. You know what I do for a living?
Yeah, Don, I swear because I got kids. So let's take a quick break. And continuing with our panel on this Friday, we have Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, Rachel Spachuk with the Idaho Statesman, Dawn Day with BoiseDev.com, and Audrey Dutton with the Idaho Capital Sun. Betsy, can we talk a bit about a bill in the State House? It's around IRS conformity, but it's been stalled
It was briefly stalled. It's actually moving.
Okay.
So what happened with that is that every year Idaho passes a bill to conform or not conform with any changes in the federal tax code, because our state income tax system is based on the federal tax code. We use the federal adjusted gross income as our starting point, and then we make the Idaho adjustments when everybody fills out their own tax return. And this year's conformity bill came up, and House Majority Leader Mike Moyle was the sponsor, and he said there's an $8 million impact, basically because the feds made some changes to things like child tax credits that lowered taxes that Idahoans pay. But Representative Heather Scott and Representative Ron Nate objected because they contended that by conforming with the IRS's definition of adjusted gross income, we were basically throwing in the towel on the issue of same-sex marriage. Mm. And that's because same-sex marriage is legal in Idaho, and it has been since 2014 through federal court decisions. But the Idaho Constitution, since 2006, has had an amendment in it forbidding same-sex marriage. That was overturned by the courts. Representatives Scott and Nate contended that, well, the Idaho Constitution still says it, so we should stick with that, and we shouldn't accept the federal definition of adjusted gross income. We should come up with our own definition of adjusted gross income, which means everyone in Idaho, in order to do their state income taxes, would have to start from scratch and recalculate everything.
Oh my goodness.
This was not a very popular proposal, but it led to a whole lot of debate. And finally, Representative Scott and Nate, although nobody else debated in favor of their position, drew another 20 members of the House to vote with them to reject the annual conformity bill, but it did pass. I believe it was 46 to 22, something like that. So that's on to the Senate. It's pretty much a standard thing that the state does every year. But it's also typical of the way that some of the more ideological members of the House fasten on to things that might seem ordinary or routine and develop ideological arguments about around them. And that slows down the business of the legislature, as we've seen in recent years. And it did that again when that bill came out.
We just don't want it to slow it down so much. We have another record number of days.
Boy, that record last year was hard to beat, and I sure hope they don't try.
Oh, right. So, Betsy, here's something interesting, and people may not know about this, and this is race-based restrictive covenants. Can you talk about that? Because this is illegal. However, we still see the wording sometimes.
Absolutely. In fact, I've seen them on my own home, and it's disconcerting when you see something like that. That's something obviously racist, saying only white people can live in this house or something like that. And this is archaic. It's something that was put in these deeds way back when, but when a deed gets recorded, it stays the same. as it goes from owner to owner. And Senator Melissa Wintrow heard from a constituent here in Boise who found this on his deed and wanted something done about it. And after a whole lot of work with a whole lot of stakeholders, she came up with something that could be done. And so she has proposed legislation that would allow anyone who finds this kind of a restrictive covenant in the documents for their home, whether it's a place they're living or owning, they could go for free and file a modification to it and get it on the record that this is not legal. And in fact, such racial restrictive covenants have not been legal since 1968 under the U.S. Fair Housing Act. And so that bill is so far passing by acclaim. It came unanimously out of the Senate committee and it headed to the Senate floor. And it's getting a lot of attention because it's a relic of something in our past that many of us thought was gone, but it's still reflected right there in the official documents in the deeds of our homes here in Idaho.
Well, even more so, Betsy, I think reflective of the fact that people don't want to believe that those things happened.
Sure. And I mean, it's hard for someone, there were people who testified at the Senate committee hearing on this saying, you know, I had someone come to me and say, this says I can't buy this house. Is this real? Can I not bid on this house? Can I not live where I want to live in the United States of America? Seeing that kind of thing can make you think that. And so that's the intent of the bill, is to stop sending those messages, because that is not what the law says.
Another interesting thing, I actually wrote about these covenants at the Idaho Press a couple of years ago. It's really difficult to get this language out, like impossible pretty much to get this language out on your own or for an HOA to do anything about it. So, you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, this legislation might be the only way for individuals to get this language out of their covenants.
Right. And Rachel, I mean, also, I think a lot of people probably were not aware that a lot of this language still existed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when it was first brought to my attention 2 years ago, I couldn't believe it. So, yeah.
Dawn, let's lighten the mood a bit. And we talked about Highway 55 with the issues in McCall, but of course, people still want to get to McCall. And you know, there's a lot of recreating that happens up there in the winter and in the summer. And so paddle boats might be something we could be seeing. Maybe could it be as soon as this summer?
It should be this summer. The McCall City Council approved a license for a business called Payette Pedal Party. Say that one time fast. our McCall reporter, Autumn Robertson, had a great story. It was actually a week ago on this, and essentially imagine the pedal bikes that you see in downtown Boise but on a boat in the lake.
That's
the idea. So you'd sit around, kind of, there's actually a photo, you sit around kind of a central bar and you'd pedal the boat with your friends and enjoy some beverages on a summer day on Payette Lake. And it's up to 16 passengers. You can book seats for the 90-minute experience. The city was involved because the pedal party people wanted to use one of the public docks there. And so they will give the city a fee of about 3% of what they take in. And this should launch this summer. You know, I had several people be like, oh, this is going to be obnoxious or annoying. And I said, that's everybody's entitled to their own individual opinion. The point that I made is, I think that some of the motorized boats will make a lot more noise in general than this. So it'll be one more boat out on the lake in McCall.
So I have to say, when I saw paddle boats, I was thinking of those nice little paddle boats you get on, you know, you paddle.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking.
A beer bike boat when you said pedal party.
Exactly.
Beer bike boat Payette pedal party. That's wow. But yeah, I mean, so it's like that. If you've done that in Julia Davis Park, where they have the little, I think they call it paddle boats there. And it's a two-seater and you go around the little pond and it's kind of fun. It's basically the same idea. The boat's just a lot bigger and it takes more people to power the pedal powered party in Payette.
And you get an adult beverage, as my children call
the ones to bring them, but
as my kids call the ones around downtown Boise a drunk truck. So there you go.
I've heard the Woo Bus. I've not heard the drunk truck. I will remember that. That sounds like a Joey special right there.
Yeah, it is. It was actually Ben. So there you go.
That's even better. That's good.
Even better. We're going to take a quick break. We'll finish off our reporter roundtable next. And wrapping up our reporter roundtable with Betsy Russell, the Boise bureau chief at the Idaho Press, as well as the voice of the I Am Boise blog, Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Statesman, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun. All right, Don, this is good news to many people's ears. Is In-N-Out really coming to Boise, coming to the Treasure Valley? I mean, the rumors, Don, they've been endless over the years.
Gemma, I'm a pretty careful reporter. And
you are.
We try not to publish stories that we don't believe in. We reviewed public records from the city of Meridian that show a fairly extensive back and forth between folks with the In-N-Out Burger Development Department and the city of Meridian about a very specific parcel at the village at Meridian. We don't have a timeline. The In-N-Out folks have in the past responded to me, but did not respond to me this time. And Village of Meridian General Manager Hugh Crawford declined to comment. But what the permits indicate is that In-N-Out Burger has selected a parcel at the corner of Fairview and Eagle in the parking lot of the Village of Meridian to build a new location with a drive-through for 40 cars, which is a lot of cars for a drive-through. And I imagine it will still overflow very often. Mm-hmm. The city of Meridian indicated in a planning report that In-N-Out Burger officials were excited to come to Idaho and excited to have the first location be in Meridian. And the planning report also said that In-N-Out officials told city of Meridian officials that they were in escrow on the property. Don't think that's super, super weird jargon, but escrow essentially means that they are going through the process of making sure that they can get the property purchased. We checked the county, and there is no transfer of that property, but sometimes those things lag a little bit. I will call back to what I said early here. We reached out to In-N-Out for comment. They have responded to me every other time I've emailed them. They did not respond this time. I also would imagine that they are sophisticated enough to have seen our story, and I have not heard from them since. So we'll see where it goes.
They haven't denied your story, Don.
Just no response. There's one note I will put here. It does not foreclose the opportunity that they could be looking at other cities as well. And we'll keep looking at that. Look, I know that In-N-Out, like anything in our society, is polarizing. Some people are very excited and some people are like, what is the hubbub? I tell you what, we're not going to be ones doing stories out when they're doing a grand opening and we don't have a helicopter, but if we did, we wouldn't fly it over. It's not our job to promote that this is happening, but we also know that it's high interest and that people are wanting to know what's happening. We want to get the facts out and then we'll move on to other stories. But this is one of the most read stories we've had in a while. So a lot of people are definitely curious.
Well, and I think I'm probably in the minority, and no one, please, no mean cut tweets. I do not understand the fascination with In-N-Out. My kids love it. I can take a pass every single time.
But I will say, go ahead.
I would say it's a free country.
Look, when I tweeted this, I had hundreds of replies, and so I have heard every opinion that there is on this. And, look, I lived in California for 10 months a couple of years ago, and I went to In-N-Out a number of times. It's not terrible. It's a good hamburger.
Not terrible. There you go.
I will say we knew about the story for 4 or 5 days before we published, and I had a burger on Friday night, and that's not typical for me. And looking back, it's probably because I was hungry for a hamburger after thinking about it all week.
There you go. Well, my kids will be happy, and so will so many other people if this actually comes to fruition. I want to thank all of you for taking time out of your very busy schedules to talk with us. A big thank you to Betsy Russell, Don Day, Rachel Spacek, and Audrey Dutton. Always great to have all of you on the show with your perspectives. Much appreciated.
Thanks for having us, Gemma.
Thank you. Have a good Friday.
You too. Thanks. And I want to thank all of you, our listeners, for being a part of Idaho Matters. Our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. Our executive producers, Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday. I hope you have a great weekend. And we will, of course, be back here on Monday.